Greetings, my dear audience. I am Peter Resnick, and welcome to the Dr. Peter Resnick's Toolbox. First, I want to thank those of you who send your emails, your feedback regarding my last week's talk about addictions. And as you may remember, I spoke about not only addictions to substances, but also addictions to mental and emotional states. So today, I have a very special guest who, though does not speak of the challenges of mental and emotional states as addictions, for sure, this person does not view these challenges as chemical imbalances of the brain. But before I introduce this person, I want to share with you something. I was blessed to have two remarkable teachers in my life. Dr. Gerald Epstein of New York and Madame Colette Aboukir Muscat of New Jerusalem. I studied with them in person for many years. And then my work was greatly influenced by three people, by me following those people's writings. I did not study with those people in person, but their writings influenced and inspired me for many years. And these three people were, or are, Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, Dr. William Glasser, and Dr. Peter Bregan. Let me say a couple of words about Dr. Peter Bregan. He's a psychiatrist who was one of the very first people who spoke up against the what is called this biological psychiatry, and it really dominates the field of psychiatry. More than 40 years ago, he started his first fight with what would be called American Psychiatric Association, the world of psychiatry. He started his fight against psychiatric methods which harm more than help. And 30 years ago, I came across his book, Toxic Psychiatry. Hi, Dr. Bregan. I was just keeping people in suspense without telling them about your name. So let me finish the sentence. So about 30 years ago, I came across one of the books of Dr. Bregan, Toxic Psychiatry. And when I read it, it opened my eyes to what was going on. And since then, I have been following his work. But I met Dr. Bregan only several weeks ago in person on the website, on Skype. And now Dr. Peter Bregan is with us. Well, Dr. Bregan, welcome, welcome. I'm so, so happy and excited to have you on the show. And I want to say something, Dr. Bregan. Although I'm excited, I'm happy to introduce you to my audience, and some of them probably know you well and know your writings. I am also excited about something else, and that is for my selfish reasons. I'm familiar with your books, and I believe there are 20 now, and I heard one time on one of your shows that you are writing actually another one. Is that correct?
Yes, I am. I'm not discussing what it's about in particular, okay. But it's a real departure about what's going on now in the world.
Okay. So, but my selfish reason is I'm really excited to get to know you as a person and to hear your personal stories. So, if you don't mind, let us start with, again, because some of people in my audience against the system. You went not against one person or someone writing an article of several people following, you know, some ideas or therapeutic approach. You went against the whole system of psychiatry. Would you please share with us what prompted you to start that on that journey?
Yes, Peter, it's interesting. What it reminds me of is that now what my wife Ginger and I are doing is we're going ahead of the whole system. We're going head on against the whole system, not the system of psychiatry, the whole system. And she said something really interesting to me, Ginger. We've been together 35 or 6 years. I've been doing reform work since 1972. But interestingly enough, we met briefly in 72 and fell in love. And I got scared, ran away. So that was, and then 10 years later, we met again. I asked her to marry me. She said yes. So that's the brief story. And we've been together 36 or 7 years now, actually.
Is and, Ginger with you right here now? I don't see.
No, Gingy, she, my beautiful wife jokes that I'm the pretty face and she's the brains behind it. So she's still shy, but she's working on it. At a very mature age, she's working on doing things more publicly. Rare occasions when she has, she's actually brilliant. But just to catch up on this thought, mm-hmm. was that, you know, we thought our whole lives that since we'd been together and she knew I'd been doing psychiatric reform since college, you know, that's like, I'm 84 now, that's 60 mm-hmm. plus years ago. And she recently said to me, you know, we thought that we were taking such a risk deciding to take on the badness that's going on surrounding COVID-19. And that it might disrupt your years of reform work in psychiatry and earn you even more enemies. She said, now I realize, she said, all that work about psychiatry and learning about the drug companies and learning about evil and control and turning people into objects, she said, you know, basically that was God's preparation for what you're doing now, because what we're doing now is about how the whole world is moving in that direction. And America risks being overwhelmed by it, which will be, maybe has been already, which will be, you know, blow against world freedom. But I'll go back to age 10. Mm-hmm. I was 10 years old, and I was, we'd gone to the movies. We used to have these things called movie tone news, and they were quite remarkable because they were like today's videos. They were motion pictures about what was going on, and all of a sudden we're seeing the liberation of a Nazi extermination camp, and I'm 10, and we didn't expect this. You know, we just thought we'd get movie tone news with the usual something or other about sports or some other topical thing. And I got scared, and it was like I didn't know what I was watching. These people were Jews. I'm Jewish. My parents are Jewish. They're lying in heaps on the ground. I thought I saw one of them moving in the heap. And I tried to hide behind the chair. And my father said, no, you should see this. Bless him, he didn't then discuss it with me. But maybe, you know, he's part of the plan. I saw this. And there was a spirit in me that said, all right, I won't run from this. After hiding behind the chair, the seat. And I said, I'm not going to let this happen to me or anybody else. If I can do anything about it, I'm not going to lie in a heap. I'll be dead first. I won't do this. I won't allow this to happen. Not that I thought I could change the world, but I was not going to go quietly. And that, you know, I think got submerged and stayed with me. One of my uncles actually was in the liberation of one of the extermination centers, and he told me about it and showed me pictures that he shouldn't have showed me, and I was probably just going on 11, you know, it was probably after the war. And then I was at Harvard, and I was in a special program. Even at Harvard, it was something hard to get into, and it was American history and literature. I thought I'd become, you know, professor of American history and literature. And then a friend invited me out to a state mental hospital. And I walked into the state mental hospital with a bunch of college volunteers, Harvard and Radcliffe. Women weren't allowed in Harvard then, so they had to be Radcliffe students. Now they're Harvard and Radcliffe, I think, or whatever they please, which is good. And I walked in, and it was even approaching it from a distance. It was like I'm seeing something I've seen before and heard about. And these ugly, awful-looking buildings that people are going to be in at the high up on this hill around this small town outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I get in there, and it's immediately like what my uncle described and what the movie Tone News looked like. It's awful. It's people in dungeons. Some are lying on the floor. When I go off by myself a little bit, I come upon somebody just being hit in the face by somebody else, and then the somebody else walks away, so there's no need to intervene. And it's like it stinks. It's just awful. The TV's not working. Just making funny pictures up on the wall. And I joined the volunteer program, and within about, I don't know, a year, maybe less, I was running it. We built an amazing program. I created something that nobody did in those days. You have to realize this is 1954, 55. Students weren't supposed to have any power. But I created a seminar. I went to the head of the Department of Psychology and at Harvard, and I said, listen, a bunch of us are working with individual patients. We talked to the superintendent into our doing more things than just cleaning up the wards and taking patients for walks and maybe having an occasional party. We want to work with individual patients, too, and we've got a bunch of people, and we're doing it. Can you make that into a seminar at Harvard for credit? I don't want to take it. I can't. But I'm gone pre-med. I didn't have that opportunity anymore. I was going to be going become a doctor, become a psychiatrist. And he said yes. So here I am at the very beginning of being a young man. I'm 18, 19. Then I got the idea for a book about the program, and that developed and was eventually published with me as one of the co-authors, because it was finished when I was gone. And I was giving talks around the country and on the East Coast, sometimes with a psychiatrist from Harvard that I got to know. And it was just astonishing. I found something important to do in the world. I knew I wanted something important, but I had no idea, you know, what it would be. Go ahead.
Amazing, Dr. Bergen. You know, I'm listening to you, and then suddenly I forgot that I'm actually the interviewer. I'm the host of the show. I'm so fascinated by the story for another reason, because you are talking about the time that was approximately 1954, right? 1956.
Yeah, it begins in 54. That's when I step in the
middle. Yeah, and 1954, I was born. And you are talking about, as a child, watching, what a synchronicity, watching that horrific show. But I grew up with these stories because my mother was one of those people in the camps. She just survived and managed then to get married. And three of us, my brother, my sister, and I were born as a result. But she was in one of those camps. So, and I kind of got hypnotized by your story. So, and I'm sorry. And so then you went to pre-med probably in 1950.
Well, 59. I actually go to medical school in 58. Uh-huh. I cram in a bunch of prereqs, and I get into a medical school, couple of medical schools, mostly on the basis of this work, which the dean of one of the schools, yeah, you know, was thought, oh, yeah, please come here. I mean, I said, well, I can't finish every requirement. He said, I don't care.
But did you already have something? Did at that time when you entered medical school, you knew that you want to be a psychiatrist? Is that right?
No question.
Did you already feel that you, like, this is my mission, I have to make changes in the field?
Well, yes, but it was a very different thing than now. Psychiatry actually had much more room for dissent in those days. There were Marxist and progressive psychiatrists. There were ordinary psychiatrists. I could have taken a residency year in community psychiatry. There were psychoanalysts who were practicing psychiatry, which is no longer true. I mean, unless there's one or two alive. So it was more open. And in fact, after I graduated in 1962, there was the last book on psychosocial psychiatry that it was ever put out by the federal government. It was the National Commission on Mental Health and Mental Illness. And they mentioned our program twice, said it was a great thing, get all the volunteers and the communities involved in the state mental hospitals. So it was different then. Now the program eventually, I mean, it must have lasted many decades or several decades, but it's gone because psychiatry teaches you can't talk to schizophrenics. They want to keep the community out so they can shock people, drug people, hit them, whatever the hell is going on. They want to be able to do with no interference. And so it's very, very different now. So when I went in, I imagined, not that I would be the number one enemy of the American Psychiatric Association with a target on my back, I imagined I'd be the youngest president in the history of the American Psychiatric, and I'd be the youngest professor at Harvard, and because I already knew so much. Would you like me to take a break and stop the dogs from barking? You got me so immediately into this without alerting me. I didn't even close the doors.
Do you mind
the dogs? We'll keep going.
I watched your interview with Dr. Zelensky, remember?
Oh, my God.
On the background, there were these kids playing. Then you invited his kids, and it was so sweet. It was so nice. This is your real living environment. And it's wonderful here, dogs.
I'm so glad. Yeah, that is my radio, what I call my radio TV show, folks, is Dr. Peter Bregan Hour. And you can just go to it as a film, really, as video, and you'll see me interviewing Peter back in January.
Yeah, and my children are first.
And you'll see my latest one is with a man named Zelnick, who was just I won't tell you anything about him other than if you watch this interview with Zev Zelnick. Zelenko, a man I love and honor and revere. It was my most mind-blowing hour with anybody I can remember, and I say that on the air. So you can just find that at the Dr. Peter Bregan YouTube channel. So where would you like me to pick up with? I can go to this to another step past medical school.
I will tell you where I want to pick it up. You know, you came in my life in 1992, I think, and when you published your book, A Toxic Psychiatry, in 1990.
Yes.
But before that, you wrote, actually, 1979, the book called Electroshock, right? It's Brain Disabling Effects.
Absolutely, yes.
So was it that then when you said, this is crazy, this is not what it was meant to be? Or you started thinking about all these psychiatric tools that they invented around that time before that? When did you start clashing?
It's very interesting, and I'll try to be a little more brief too, if you like. That happened is a very distinctive time that it happened. I had decided at the last minute medical school not to apply for a big Harvard internship because I heard about Thomas Sasse. He had just published a book called The Myth of Mental Illness. And I looked at this book and I'd already sent in these internship applications to Boston. And I called the program he was at in upstate New York, where I live now, but in Syracuse at the state, Upstate Medical Center. And I said, I'd like to meet Dr. Zas. I'd like to apply for your internship, because it's actually instead of a one-year medical internship, I can do 6 months of psychiatry and tack that on to my residency, have some extra training. So I want to come up, and they said, well, that's all closed, and you can't, we've only got two interns, and it's closed. I said, well, I can come up and meet you people? And somebody said, yes. And I came up, and I met Thomas Zas, and for the first time, I met somebody whose thinking seemed in some areas more advanced than mine. How's that for a young man coming out of medical school? He was talking about liberty in a way I'd never heard. I thought about love and affiliation, but he's adding liberty. Didn't know, poor Tommy, didn't know much about love. It's gone now. It's SZASZ, The Myth of Mental Illness. And so I went there for that year, and I was in the internship program, and I fit beautifully into this amazing program at Syracuse, which was only going to last a brief time before they destroyed it. And I decided, but I got to go to Harvard. So I went down to Harvard, I interviewed, and it sounded just like the place I'd heard about. They had a lot of psychologists involved, in addition to psychiatrists. They were doing family therapy. I was already on my own, the first person doing family therapy, as an intern up in Syracuse, because I've been reading the literature on it. And I get there now, and I walk in, and there's a briefing, and it turns out that Harvard has changed. And we're not psychoanalytically or psychologically oriented now. In fact, you'll have two patients this whole year that you can see intensively, just two, and you're going to learn about ward management and drugs. Well, I knew some of these people from when I was running the volunteer program, so I went to the man who was director of research, who would later become director of NIMH, Jerry Clareman. I said, Jerry, what's going here? He said, well, Peter, what are you interested in? And I said, I'm interested in developing new ideas about the human mind and how it works and how we relate to each other. He laughed and said, that's not psychiatry now, Peter. It's changed. It's about, and this is practically a quote, it's about computer diagnosing and prescribing medication. And I thought, what is going on here? And so I went there, and I was really blessed because there was a supervisor there from the old time named John Mack, a very, very interesting man. And he liked me, and I liked him, so I was protected. But after 1 year, I decided I'd rather be back at upstate New York. I didn't know that was about to be attacked by the state of New York and destroyed. Because of the book, The Myth of Mental Illness, they were going to try to destroy Tom Zoss and the wonderful program around him. And so I went to the director and I said, I'm going to be leaving now. And he said, you can't leave. You haven't done anything wrong. I said, no, I'd rather be upstate New York. I'm just more comfortable there. I said, there I was given lectures and I was part of the system and I, you know, wrote something for the newsletter, and I just feel like this is a setback for me, and I'd like to go. Or I was probably nicer than that. And he said, well, you can't leave because no one's ever left a Harvard program before.
An embarrassing part.
I wished him good luck, and I went up to Syracuse, and they just said, come back, and I did. So I finished up working with Zoss. But during that time, they disenfranchised Zoss, the state of the head of mental health in the state refused to let him teach in the small teaching hospital that was a state hospital, acute treatment center, wouldn't let him set foot in it. He got very isolated, but he didn't care. He was just sort of isolated anyway, and he went on the rest of his life writing books about liberty, but not about love, not about affiliation. So he was missing out, and he deeply unhappy that his favorite student was writing about love. What is that nonsense?
Dr. Bregman, I'm sorry. Actually, your book, Toxic Psychiatry, has a longer title. It's Toxic Psychiatry, Why Therapy, Empathy, and Love Must Replace the Drugs, Electroshock, and Biochemical Theories of the New Psychiatry. Now, my question to you, I don't remember if I read it in one of your books, or I read this in someone else's book, or actually it's a result of a conversation with a friend psychiatrist. I don't remember. But I remember definitely reading or hearing this, that imagine if I'm a psychiatrist, I spend 1 hour with a patient and I get paid, let's say, $200.
That's out of my book.
Right, great. And then if I see six people, if I prescribe drugs, I can see five or six people for the same time. So my question is, it is from your book. I don't remember which one because I read many.
Me neither. I don't know which one either, but it is from,
so
it's Michael, exactly something
is
I discussed.
All about money?
Yes, in the long run, it's all about money. And power. I think one of the things is I look at the world, and I look at these global predators in the world that are running, trying to run things. And I think there are three motives for evil. And one is wealth. One is glory and self-aggrandizement, and one is pure power. Mm-hmm. And wealth is often the starting point. Because if you shift the allocation of money, people shift all their professional work and all their professional interests. And there's no question about it. But they also were getting more power. They were becoming part of the most powerful thing there is, which is the manipulation of people as objects. It was just right out front. That's how we're going. Computers, diagnosis computers, and giving medications. And of course, they would have been giving brain surgery if that. Let me jump to that. I mean, what really got me started. Yes, yeah, and I'll take a minute with that, and then draw a deep breath, because that really tells you how I got going eventually. So I finished. I had had a stellar background. So I got into the U.S. Public Health Service as an officer and lieutenant commander. I was assigned to NIMH. It was like a plum of plums to get on graduation. And I realized that NIMH was also going in this new direction. I was watching this unfold before my eyes, that it was just not going to be the place it had once been, where biological psychiatry was literally a center within what was essentially a kind of political social approach, a center. Then biological psychiatry became the NIMH, totally. Mm-hmm. And I saw this happening, and I realized I had no future in psychiatry as an establishment. But I wasn't interested in living a life of being terrorized and frightened much of the time. Mm-hmm. I was going to live a good life. I had long hair. I wore jeans. I went into private practice, and to my astonishment, I loved it. I didn't want to go into private practice because I thought it was kind of selfish. You know, what do? You enjoy yourself talking with people all day long. You make a nice living. But, there was that part of me that wanted to do larger things, not to change the world, but to bring all this stuff into the world that was good, that I thought about and that other people had thought about. Tradition of psychology that I was felt a part of, and so on. And then I'm doing that. I'm writing novels. My first novel came out, which was an indictment of my experience at Harvard, but it was a novel.
1972. Right?
That's right. Wait a minute. I guess
after
it is.
After the Good War.
No, it's 1970. It's 1970, The Crazy from the Sane. Oh. And at that time, I was writing another novel. I would end up writing another novel, which had a very good publisher, good advance, and they were looking at me as a novelist. And I'm sitting in my office, and I read that lobotomy is coming back in the psychiatric newspaper. Lobotomy is coming back? The second national convention ever, big international conference in Copenhagen. I didn't even know where Copenhagen was. I was not very international or globalistic in my thinking. And I could not believe it. I thought, no, this cannot happen. Somebody has to say no this time. This cannot happen again. And so I wrote away to everybody who was in the conference I could find, all their names. Nobody knew that I was essentially a very strong critic of the profession. And that's the watchdogs. So be careful, folks. Well, those are my watchdogs.
Well, you know you're safe.
And one of them's huge, one of them's medium size, and one is so tiny that they'll untie your shoelaces while they bite you on the foot.
Well, so got a lot of people angry. So you need to stay safe and protected.
Oh God. And they didn't know about me, and I was at the time I was in a very plush place called the Washington School of Psychiatry, which came out of a very great tradition of psychotherapy for psychosis, which doesn't exist there anymore, and it's all been eradicated by power, money, and so I started getting all this stuff. I found out they were operating on little black children in Mississippi at the University of Jackson in Mississippi, 4, 5, 6 years old, real proud of it, putting in dozens of electrodes in their brains, kids who were essentially, you know, these are abandoned children. And I wondered if they were all black. I got a hold of a civil rights activist in town. He said, I don't even have to go in, sir. That's a segregated institution. And so here's this, you know, great white doc. And I woke up with a nightmare not long after that I was a little black child and I could smell my brain melting. I mean, it just freaked me out. And you can see the connection to the state hospital. You can see the connection to the 10-year-old boy sitting in the theater and seeing Jews, you know, being overwhelmed. And so I decided I was going to stop the return, the international return of lobotomy and psychosurgery. I was told by the assistant director of NIMH, Peter, these guys will eat you alive. You can't go up against them. They'll eat you alive. Well, they had nothing. They had no principles. They had no values.
They broke their teeth, huh?
They really did. They broke their teeth. Then I stopped most of the projects in the world. We still have a couple here and there, and they're trying to do it in new ways. But, I mean, I really broke the backbone. It took me years. And I was broke at the end. But, you know, I feel I've been well taken care of. That's how I got into all this stuff, Peter.
You know, you actually got me a little bit in trouble because I know it's your influence. A while ago, I made a little video called, and I don't know even if you subscribe to this idea that I have, but the video was called, Can It Be That Anxiety and Depression Are Addictions? And I kind of expanded on the idea that, you know, people are not chemically imbalanced when they're depressed. They are just very chemically appropriate to the state of sadness or grief that they experience. Their chemistry changes, brain chemistry changes. And if they're elated, their brain chemistry changes as well. And it's all appropriate to the state they're in. And then they're given medication, and then their brain chemistry really isn't appropriate. Was I off? What do you think? Because why do I say that you got me in trouble? Because I got a number of very favorable reviews and people wrote to me, and so on. But I got some angry emails from two psychiatrists and one social worker and one psychologist saying, you don't know what you're talking about. It's poor victims of chemical imbalance that who are suffering, and you are taking their attention away from real medicine. So I just wanted you to.
Yeah.
Am I really off?
Well, you're right. You're right on target. I mean, folks, listening to this, I mean, this is what is done to people when you want to control them. You teach them that there's something terribly the matter with them. The Jews are vermin. You know, the blacks are inferior. Whatever. And half the population is supposed to be mentally ill. It's and then we all make money on it. We monetize people. We monetize children, give them drugs. So it's just a wretched, wretched approach to human beings, which is now becoming global with Amazon and Twitter and these giant corporations and the drug industry and Bill Gates and so on and so forth. This is a global attitude toward human beings now, which is why I've shifted the work I do. I haven't abandoned the psychiatry work, but I've shifted the emphasis now toward, I was just learning about the model of totalitarianism. Can I take another minute and say something that people will find fascinating?
Sure, absolutely.
One of the things I learned during the anti-psychosurgery movement that I created, I was on the air one day, a young man called me. Maybe he wasn't young at the time. Richard Abrams, I think his name was. And he said, you know, he called in on the station. I was on WBAI in New York City. And he said, you know, Dr. Bregan, people say you exaggerate, but you know, you really don't. I'll give an example. For example, you took Hannah Arendt, who was a philosopher, kind of progressive, and said, you took her for granted when she said that the Nazis, that the Germans killed, you know, 100,000 mental, 10,000 or 20,000 mental patients before the Holocaust began. he said it was an organized program that began entirely from psychiatry. They killed at least 100,000 Germans and hundreds of thousands of more people, and they set up the Holocaust. They set up the machinery, the physical machinery, in their extermination camps for it. And he went on the air, and he sent me photos. He said, I liberated one of these camps. One of these places. I was one of two soldiers who were the liaison to the public after we took over. I think it was Bavaria. I could be wrong on this part. But the state hospital in town was Kaufbeuren, and we were there. And the war was still going on, but not in that area. And Wehrmacht doctor, a German. Air Force doctor came in and said, I just learned that they're systematically killing the mental patients in my state hospital. Would you put a stop to it, please? So he was just two guys. He picked up, I think maybe he or the other guy picked up a Tommy gun, and they went and they liberated the state mental hospital. And they found in the hospital a huge records. The Germans were so scrupulous about all the people killed. They found ovens that they were cremating the patients in. Now, they were not gassing them. They were starving them and poisoning them to death, their entire population, and bringing in more, batches of more. And he showed me a picture of the state mental hospital, the hospital superintendent, who had hung himself when he heard they were coming. So it's not like they didn't know they were evil. I mean, that's interesting.
I never heard anything like that.
Wow. And I wrote a paper about this eventually. I studied that. I wrote the first paper really by an American about this when I got in touch with a German who'd written a marvelous book about it that had been translated, who was a geneticist and who knew the ugliness of the genetic stuff. And then I got invited to Germany to give a paper because I was actually one of the experts now at the first international conference ever held. It was in the 80s on medicine in the Third Reich. I don't think they ever held another one. And I talked about the Holocaust as the entering wedge into the atrocities of Hitler in the Holocaust. So it was the euthanasia program of the psychiatrists, so-called euthanasia program, which had been planned since at least 1920, before Hitler was even in power. So here it all came together. It was like psychiatry was like this kind of evil seat of things existing in different cultures, being used by the Russians in one way, the Germans in another way, the Cubans in another way.
What about Americans? I'm sorry. Didn't it start creating a perfect race in America where whatever 40 states accepted the whole idea that mentally ill people should be lobotomized or euthanized? No?
Yes, there was a strong movement in the U.S. before Hitler came to power that was not so much a euthanasia movement as a eugenical concept of sterilization. Well, it became a euthanasia movement, but it didn't get very far. All of this, by the way, folks, you can find in one of two sources. One is a book by my wife and I together called The War Against Children of Color. You'll have to just find a used copy on Amazon or some other place. But on my website, if you search murder of mental patients, you'll eventually get to, or words like that, you'll get to a paper I wrote on the psychiatric Holocaust, murder of mental patients, that has all the details of this, enormously detailed paper that I gave in Germany and that was then published in a European journal. Couldn't get it published in hardly any other journal in the world, other than this one, which was about risk and safety in medicine. They thought this was a pretty big risk and we needed to be safe from it. And so I just got into having this overview that this, whatever this deadly thing that's wrong, and you're absolutely right, Peter, about the murder. Well, they did massive sterilizations. And when Hitler was considering starting a sterilization program as his first legislation with a psychiatrist writing it, Ernst Rudin, Hitler had people get together with the Americans, and he invited the Americans to Berlin. And they told him and his henchmen that you will have no trouble doing mass sterilization in Germany with doing it in the U.S. without a problem.
Wow.
So we actually gave hope. And then the eugenics journals and eugenic journals and genetic journals would be more accurate. The genetic journals, some of the other medical journals, they thought Hitler was the first mental health hygiene leader of a country.
Mm.
I mean, that's the craziness. And we're there now with Fauci. Fauci is a violent human being. You can go to my resource center on Bregan.com, and right at the top, I'm emphasizing the COVID-19 resource center, and you'll see some of the stuff that I'm working on now in amazing blogs. You can go to a video that's had 50,000 downloads about how Fauci was funding the very viruses, the development of the viruses that led to the current SARS-CoV-2. They were making SARS-CoV viruses with China, funded by America and by Fauci. And one of the reasons I decided maybe I had something to contribute, because when Ginger and I put out our blog and then my video on this, we not only got 40, 50,000 hits right away of viewers, we got it to Trump. And he canceled the program. Trump canceled Fauci's funding of Chinese experiments on making nasty viruses. But they knew what they knew what to do. Boy, that's far afield. But that's again these directions of these people who treat human beings like objects. I do believe for Fauci, it's the world is kind of, he views kind of the people of the world, I think, the way a Hitler viewed Jews, you know, and many other people, kind of not with that hate, but with a kindly disregard for their lives. And you'll see what I'm writing about with a lot of help from Ginger and with tons of other doctors involved in this. I was the conscience of psychiatry. I was the point man for decades. And now I'm working in an area where there are other people who know much more than I do. There are wonderful doctors who welcome me because they appreciate what I've done with the psychiatry issues. They see the similarities. So there's a wonderful new group you'll learn about. Watch my TV show, like the one that Peter's on. You'll see these amazing doctors who are taking on the establishment in the world and saying, we have good treatments. We don't need this awful vaccine. We don't need this crappy remdesivir that Fauci foisted off on the world that doesn't work and poisons people. We've got old-time, inexpensive medicines with which to treat these viral disorders. We don't have to have a vast number of deaths. And so you see the similarity, the vast numbers of deaths that are happening, you know, that don't have to happen. Wow. I'm giving you the largest overview, Peter, on this.
I love it. But, you know, I wish we had a two-hour show.
No, I'd get tired. So I'm too old for a two-hour show.
God willing, we'll have many, many shows to...
Well, I love talking with you. You're just such, I know I'm doing all the talking, but heck, I'm the interviewee. That's good. Almost always I'm the interviewer.
I have another question, and it's kind of in a little different area, but again, as I said, it's my selfishness. That is, it's more me. I want to know. there was time when I read one of your books and I said, I would love to be, I used to joke with my students. I said, this guy should be paying me commissions because I make all my students to read his book, The Heart of Being Helpful.
Yes.
And at that, when I read your book, this book, I said, I would love to be a fly on the wall and to see how he's working, particularly that, you know, again, the toxic psychiatry talks about empathy and love. And then you also have this book, after the good war, the love story. So you are so much into what love and connectedness. So I would love to hear, how do you, in your work, how do you connect with people in such a way that that they get transformed. They don't need to look for something outside of them to fix them.
Well, one of the things I'm trying to do is get just a tad more commercial now that I don't work so hard. And I do have a wonderful training video. It is it's more popular than my books on my website. So there is a Peter Bragan training video that shows me interviewing four or five patients and then two therapists, not psychiatrists, evaluated afterward, and people in the audience to join in. So it's quite interesting, and it's very widely and it's training videos are in the hundreds of dollars. This is not. It's accessible. So the whole key that I found out in the state mental hospital was that it was something I felt with one of the big keys was there, but for the grace of God go I remember being told that the young woman, seemingly young, but she was tattered and lying on the floor near the radiator, had been a Radcliffe student. And I thought, oh my God, there, for the grace of God, go I. And I wasn't afraid of her. I tried to talk with her. I don't think I succeeded. I succeeded with a lot of people, but I can't remember succeeding with her, and tried to, relate to her. And all these people who were supposed to be diseases and so bad, they just so glad to see us, volunteers. I was on a violent ward, most women's ward, and I walked throughout the hospital. Eventually, I didn't return the set of keys I was given. So I had keys to all the wards. And I never got threatened. I wasn't very big, but I was prepared to, I was very, I never got let anybody bully me my entire life, despite my size, never, unless they had a gun, maybe. I was not afraid physically for some strange reason, but I didn't get threatened. I mean, the worst threat I remember, and it scared me, I'm walking through a ward I'm not familiar with, a big, huge man comes over, looks down on me from a foot above me and says, I smoke Lucky Strike. And I said, oh, that's wonderful. And other people were talking about, how do you defend yourself if you get attacked? And I would say, I look harmless and caring. And so I defend myself from getting attacked. Not like I was when I was a kid, when I look like, mess with me and you're going to be really shocked. But I learned that that doesn't really get you what you want. It gets you in fights. One thing, you want to be gentle and kind and avoid all that craziness in the male world. And so that was just apparent to me. So then we set up a program. We had, I don't remember, this is in Toxic Psychiatry, and it's also, been written up professionally. But we, I got the superintendent to give us 15 or patients of our own, I think was the number. And each of us had our own patient. And we met once a week with a wonderful social worker. So it was very inexpensive to the, we met as a group, very inexpensive to the hospital, and they tried to give us patients that we couldn't hurt because they'd been there so long they were probably, they couldn't be moved, you couldn't hurt them. And nonetheless, by the way, the Boston Psychoanalytic Society intervened, tried to stop the program on the grounds we'd hurt the patients. I mean, that's really early I was seeing this vicious politics. These guys never set foot in a state hospital. They're just worried about their turf. There are kids doing therapy over at Harvard. We got to stop this. So we got 12 or 13 of the 15 out of the hospital, back to their homes, some in good, better nursing homes, but back into the community, almost every one of them. That's what was written up in that big national mental health a book that came out in 62, the last of the psychosocial psychiatry books. So it was just obvious to me it was about relationship. And I don't know how I knew. I did not come from a loving background. That gets much too intimate and involved to talk about here. But I just knew it somehow. Like I'd been touched in some way. And I was talking about love. I tried to write about love in the book, but the that we published from the program, but they edited it all out. That was another beginning of my seeing, geez, what they don't want to hear. Why don't they want to hear anything about love and psychiatry?
So you're saying the greatest tool in psychology, psychiatry, is really not a tool, but empathy and connectedness with people who are in pain.
That's so sweet that you say it, because I'll tell you something funny. I was very, very hesitant about your program because you talk about tools and I hate tools.
Right.
But I knew right away when we talked, you're an amazing man. I was going to love this person, relate to this person. But not tools.
Yeah.
But
It's a way of being.
And what I try to describe in the book, as you know so well, probably better than me from teaching it, in the heart of being helpful, is I talk about a kind of way of radiating caring, having a healing presence about you, being there for the other human being. And people, it helps everybody. But the most astonishing thing is how much it helps people who are absolutely psychotic. They just get right away that there's a different thing going on here. And then I tell them, I know you're scared because you've seen a lot of psychiatrists, and every time you tell them anything important, they want to drug you more or lock you up. But I want to tell you, I'm different. I never lock people up. I just won't do it. I'll take the risk, but I won't lock you up. So, you know, take care of yourself for my sake and yours. We're a team, because I'm not going to lock you up and I'm not going to drug you. I'm going to help you come off the drugs. I hope you will want to. And they all want to. We'll do that. But if you come in and tell me you're suicidal, I'm not going to raise your dose. I'm just going to talk to you and say that, well, that's, you know, and of course, I mean, who hasn't been suicidal? Let's talk about it. The more suicidal you are, the more you must love life because you hate the way it is. You know, everything is good. We're going to work all this out. We can do this. Such a different message. My colleagues, if you tell them you're suicidal, they say, we can't do this. Here's a drug. I can't even bear to hear this. I want to get my pad out right now. I'm thinking about my colleagues. What's going to happen if you kill yourself? You want to murder your kids? Stop. I'm locking you up. You realize what that'll do to me if you murder your kids? I'll get sued. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not with the person. Now, by the way, I do believe that if somebody's going to murder their kids, you have an obligation, and it's a legal one, to intervene in some way. It's vague. You got to call the other person. You got to do something meaningful. But I only had that once in my life. I had a man who sounded like he was going to go home and get in a fight with his wife, and this time he was going to really hit her once in my whole career. That at the end of the session, I hadn't calmed him down by just being with him. See, if you don't have an emergency, the other person's emergency goes away. They come in with an emergency. If you're a psychiatrist, you give a drug, you think about hospitalization, they know they have an emergency. You've told them you're going to drug you, put you in a hospital. I communicate, you don't have an emergency, you're in a safe place, and we work it out. And we do. But in this case, he was gone his way home. And he wasn't going to stay, or I don't know. Usually, if I could, I'd just say, well, stay here a while. But it didn't, because he didn't want to stay. I was worried. So I said, well, I want your permission. I don't need it, but I want your permission to call your wife before you go. He said, sure, call her, basically, you know, cursing. So I called her. I said, I'm your husband's psychiatrist. He's leaving the office. I just feel obliged to let you know that I'm afraid he's feeling very violent toward you. And she basically said, get out of my life. Who do you think you are calling me?
You know, behind your back, which means before you and I met, speaking about you to my students, I used to call you a great troublemaker who heals with love and tries to ruin and get bankrupt pharmaceutical companies.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
So what, well, we've been going about an hour, right?
Yeah,
so
yes. It will.
So what do you want us to talk about for a few minutes? Something about your aura and also about where I am now, that I'm just talking about myself and my legacy. Folks, I am literally going to be 85 in May. And I am so blessed to be doing more important work maybe than ever, and joined with others instead of being alone. And
particularly that they are now talking about re-education, and it reminds me of re-education camps in China. Those people who, 74 million people who voted for Trump, need to be re-educated, something. They're probably chemically imbalanced. They voted for him, you see?
Yeah, folks, they really are doing this. We're in a very dangerous situation right now. And, you know, if you go to my, everything on YouTube's free. If you go to my YouTube, we don't have ads. I don't, maybe we have ads. I don't control it or worry about it, but we don't get any money. It just gives you information about what's going on in the big world.
Dr. Brigham, I have so many more questions. I hope we'll have another hour.
We will get together again, sir.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming to this show, and I'm really grateful for you being there as one of my teachers. Thank you again.
Well, thank you. And thank you for just taking what I say so seriously. And thank your audience for taking this seriously. You all are listening to one of the best psychologists there are in Peter Resnick. He's just really on to what's right and what's real. It's a pleasure to know you.
Oh, keep talking. I would want to give you another 20 minutes to talk about that.
No, we only have 2 minutes. That's the limit. So I'll say that this is a mensch. It's a Yiddish term. I don't speak Yiddish, but my parents used to occasionally say a word that I got to know. He's a real person. He's a real caring person. And at the same time, he's got a rare combination of intellect and feeling. I imagine that if he took that, what is that profile test? It's the only test I think that has any use to people. The Myers-Briggs, probably. What are you? What are you?
I don't know. I never took the test.
I think depending on how Peter took the test, he'd come out both as a thinker or a feeler, and a feeler, because he goes in all those directions.
I'm supposed to talk about you, not you about me.
Well, you're lucky. I only have 2 more minutes. This is a really good man, and I don't usually open my heart this way, so I suspect that his clients do, and I understand that he has clients all over the world. And, you know, I have no idea whether he helps people or not, but I'd be astonished if he didn't. I mean, I don't know anybody that he knows. So I think you'd be taking a good risk talking to this man. And I had him on my show, and I felt better afterward. And I'm going to just feel real good about myself from talking to him today. A little tired, but real good. So this is a good man, and give him all the support you can. And if he ever comes under heavy attack, give him tons of support. Give him tons. Okay, that's enough.
Thank you very much. God bless.
God bless.
And thank you, my dear audience, for being with me today. And next week, I will have another guest, and his name is Dr. Oleg Resnick. And it's not coincidence, yes. He is my nephew, but that's not why I invited him, but because he wrote a wonderful book called Secrets of Medical Decision Making. And I think it may be interesting for you to hear what he has to say, particularly what's happening today in the world of medicine. Again, thank you for being with me today, and I hope to have you here next week. Peace to all who want to live in peace.